KTOO Public Media would like to acknowledge the Flane D and the Wushkitan of the Akquan. We are on their ancestral homeland. Our broadcast studios are built on fill that was once tideland and part of what is called the Indian Village. We recognize those families who maintained smokehouses on the tidelands, parked their boats in the harbor, and gathered driftwood for fuel. The families of the Juneau Indian Village, like their ancestors, cherish and depend upon their immediate connection to the waterfront. KTOO is working to lift up Tlingit voices through the sharing of stories like these and the broadcast of the Tlingit language. Please excuse us for our mistakes and gunashchish for your patience as we learn.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakhaya ha anikach gunashchish.
You're tuned in to Juneau Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, coming to you live from my living room in sunny downtown Juneau, Alaska, and thanks to Scott Burton for zooming me into the studio today. The first guest on the show is Derek Sykes, curator of insects, professor of entomology at University of Fairbanks. Hello, Derek.
Hi.
I've never met a curator of insects before. Can you tell me a little bit about what that entails?
Yeah, so I'm responsible for the insect collection in the University of Alaska Museum, which resides on the campus of University of Alaska Fairbanks, but it's really a statewide collection, so we call it the University of Alaska Museum of the North, affectionately. It's the collection I manage is very young, started in the year 2000, and I've been growing it as I was hired in 2006, so one of my big jobs has been collecting a lot of insects and getting them into the museum and turning them into specimens that we make useful for science around the world.
What are some of the highlights of the insect collection at the Museum of the North?
Highlights. Well, we, because we're such a young collection, one of the things that separates us from a lot of other big museum collections is that we've been able to do things in a very modern digital way from the get-go. And that has allowed us to make the University of Alaska Museum collection available online in a much more thorough, comprehensive manner than many other older, larger museums who have a much more kind of tedious and onerous task of dealing with this long backlog of undatabased or undigitized specimens. But one thing that a lot of people probably aren't aware is that there's millions of specimens in museums that aren't in a database, that aren't in a computer. There's no record of them. So getting them into the computer is a very slow, time-consuming process. And we've been able to do it very efficiently and very successfully. So that sets us apart as one of the leaders in North America.
And before we started this interview on the air, you were telling me that you are working on a paper with an undergraduate. It's close to being published about insects that have been found indoors, some of which have been found inside the museum. Would you say more about that?
Yeah. So a lot of people think about when biologists study the natural world, we think about nature is outside of the buildings. And if any nature gets inside the buildings, it's like an annoying pest, or it's maybe a pet, like a lovely cat, or maybe you have a pet colony of pet cockroaches, like I do in my house. if they're living in your house uninvited, then or your museum, then these are considered pests usually, and they haven't really that whole. Like ecosystem and food web of organisms that get into buildings hasn't really been studied ecologically. So there's a colleague of mine down in North Carolina who really started pioneering this work a few years ago. They went to a whole bunch of different houses and did surveys inside the houses and published on their results. And I thought it would be really interesting to do this in the subarctic and be the first to do this in a big museum. So I had an undergraduate in one of my entomology classes who was looking for a project, and I said, "Hey, let's analyze this 18-year data set, because while I've been working in the museum, anything that was found alive inside the museum, spiders, beetles, little flies, stuff all over the place, we collected it and added it to the collection. So we had this pretty big data set. And we found some interesting stuff. Some beetles that had never been recorded in Alaska before. There's even these little things called bark lice. They're pretty small. Most people would have trouble seeing them without a microscope. Certainly, you wouldn't be able to recognize what kind of insect they are without a microscope. But there's two species of bark lice living in the museum that continually live. I mean, they're not accidentals. They didn't just, some of the things we find are accidentals. We get like one specimen and that's it. But these bark lice, they're living in the museum. And at least one of these species has never been found outside of any building anywhere. Like it is, around the world, it's only been found living indoors. So there are these species that have it sort of adapted, taken advantage of humans. And human dwellings are like, you know, really fancy caves for them. You know, they can thrive on our detritus and our food scraps and whatever else. So there's a whole food web and ecology going on. And I'm really looking forward to this paper coming out. It should be out in a month or two.
That's really interesting. Kind of a fun project and maybe one of those things that pops up that wasn't planned, but
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Study. How did you get into studying insects and entomology?
I always say my earliest memory was very young. I must have been five or something, and I was laying on the ground looking at an ant colony that was swarming. So all the reproductive ants, males with wings, were coming out of the colony, and I was just eye level with the ants and fascinated and so engrossed that I did not notice the ants crawling into my clothing and into my pants. And when I finally realized I was covered in ants, I went running inside, and my grandmother was in hysterics as ants started spilling out of my pants into the kitchen. And so I think I was pretty much, you know, meant to be an entomologist from that day on. But it wasn't until I got to college that I actually knew there was a course and a field of study devoted to insects. Oddly enough, I never really learned about it at a younger age.
Well, that actually sounds nightmarish. I'm surprised that it attracted you to the field instead of repelled you.
I was just fascinated by the ants, so I was clearly more interested in them than what they were doing on my clothing.
Do you have any particular classification of insect that you would call your favorite to study?
Oh, beetles. Yeah, I'm a beetle specialist. So I've been working on beetles since I kind of started focusing on them during my master's degree back in 1992. I even focused on a beetle as my undergraduate, so that was 1991. So I've been working on beetles for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Beetles is kind of a broad category. Do you have any particular, any that you find particularly interesting?
Yeah, so I'm a world expert on what are called burying beetles. They're also called sexton beetles in England, and these are carrion beetles. So they will bury a small vertebrate carcass, like a dead bird or a mouse or a vole or something like that. We have two species that are pretty commonly found, and even a third in Alaska. But I did my PhD on those beetles, and they're found globally. Some of them are a conservation concern. One of them is a federally endangered species in North America. It used to be found over half of the continent, and now it's gone from 95% of its former range. And it's also the largest member of the group for North America. So it was kind of a very striking, and these beetles are strikingly handsome. They're usually black with orange markings. So when people see them, they jump right out, and they're pretty big too. But they're also a conservation concern because they're cold adapted beetles. They don't do well in hot, dry environments. Where they do occur in the tropics, they usually occur at the high elevations up where the forests are cooler. And oftentimes these are on islands or mountaintops, and you end up with, you know, there's this general concern with climate change that the heat is moving up slope, and so you end up with warmer and warmer climate, and the organisms have to move further and further up to keep their preferred temperature. And of course, you can only move up so far on a mountain before you run out of mountain.
Well, that's a good segue into what you're here on the show to talk about, which is that this Friday you're the featured speaker for the Evening at Egan Lecture Series. The title of your talk is Climate Change Impacts on Insects in Alaska and Globally. What's interesting or unique about the insect population of Alaska?
Well, initially, there's a general trend. There's a lot fewer species the further you get to the North and South Pole. The further you get away from the equator, the fewer species you have. So Alaska is probably one of sort of the smallest lists, the lowest biodiversity of species. But we still have at least 9,000 species, and that list is growing all the time. Since I've started work, we've added 1,000 species to the list. So it's just going up and up and up. And some of those, not very many, but some of those are very likely new additions to the state. Like people are bringing in, or we have, you know, some invasive species, we have some non-native species that are sort of innocuous. Not very many of those. Most of these new discoveries are species that just have been overlooked in the past. No one's been looking for them. So it's a small diversity, so that makes it manageable. There's still an enormous, you know, lifetimes amount of work to do. And I'm only one, you know, insect curator in the state, and other states with lots of agriculture and a lot more insect species have a lot more museums and curators and people working on the insects of their state. So it's a much sort of smaller, more manageable problem up here, but we're still resource limited.
Mm-hmm. And is this topic, the way climate change is affecting insects in Alaska and beyond, is this something you've been researching for a while? You can like tell what the effects are over time?
Yeah, so you really do need a long time series, and that's one thing that museum data are pretty good at providing. But there have been some studies that have been coming out, some more ecological studies, and I'll be reviewing this in the talk, but studies, you know, we have a general, well, I'll get back to your question. Have I been studying it for a long time? Personally, no. Personally, my main focus has been building the collection itself. And that means just getting a lot of specimens into the collection. And we're basically going for diversity. We're trying to get as many species as possible into the collection. To understand climate change, though, what generally you need is it's sort of a consistent data set over a long time period of some species or closely related species that you can track their population. And that can be a little challenging from a museum perspective because you have a big effort effect. You know, there was a butterfly collector named Ken Phillip who lived in Fairbanks. He started work in the 60s, late 60s, and up here, and he died in 2014, but he's the author of the Butterfly Guide for Alaska. And his collecting effort was enormous in the 1970s. And then it kind of slowly tapered off as time went on. And if you look at his collection effort, you might think, oh, there were a lot of butterflies in the 1970s and not very many in the 80s and even less in the 90s. But that's really more a reflection of how much effort he was putting out, not how many actual butterflies that were out there. So that's what gives you a sense of the challenge that you have in using data to understand changes in insect abundance. You really have to have kind of a consistent collection method over a long time period where the effort doesn't change. Yeah.
So what aspects of this topic are you examining when it comes to climate change and insect populations?
Well, a couple different ones. I've been reviewing the literature globally and keeping so that there's a number of interesting studies that have been coming out around the world. So I summarized some of that and some of the basic sort of more intuitive changes you expect to see are species moving northward and also moving up elevation. And I was involved in a large study looking at bumblebees where they use museum data in North America and Europe over 100 years of data. And it was very, very large scale study. And what they found was indeed the bumblebees were disappearing from the southern edge of their range. But they weren't moving north. So that was kind of the mysterious part of that study. We didn't have evidence of them moving north, and we don't know why they aren't moving north. But the problem there is you're basically getting their ranges are getting contracted. They're getting smaller rather than just shifting. We expect things to shift, but sometimes organisms have trouble moving, and they may you know just disappear. So that's very concerning. But there are other less intuitive changes that are happening. I had a grad student looking at butterfly climate change effects on butterflies using that big data set from Ken Phillips, the butterfly collector. And she looked at flight or seasonal changes in butterflies in the Fairbanks area and found that a significant number of species have started flying earlier in the year, which is not too surprising because we know that the growing season is expanding as well, and the butterflies respond to temperature. So as, you know, if the spring is getting warmer earlier, the butterflies are going to be flying earlier. So that was one of her chapters, and the other looked at, and Catherine Daly was her name, she also looked at body size changes on the North Slope in the Arctic. And this was following up on work done in Greenland where they found butterflies were getting smaller following warmer years. The warmer the preceding year was, the smaller the subsequent adult butterflies were. So the temperature that the caterpillar was growing under affected the size of the adults. And Catherine found the same thing for two of the three species she looked at in the North Slope. So those are some of the studies we've been looking at, and they're not, you know, they're not all intuitive. I had another grad student looking at beetles that specialize on a lot of them specialize on snowfields, so they're alpine beetles, and they use snowfields as the way a spider uses a web. So if you ever go up hiking in the mountains and you see snowfields, if you look, you'll find all kinds of dead insects kind of stuck to the snowfield. And what happens is these insects get blown up from lower elevations. They then get cold and fall onto the snow and ice, and they just freeze there. And it's like a giant refrigerator. So there are species that take advantage of that, and they have adapted to living up there. And they go out on the snowfields and they scavenge these insects. And so he was studying these beetles, and two of the species that he described as new, so they were undescribed, but one of them had not been collected since 1979. And it was only known from one mountain down in Oregon. So it could very well be gone at this point. We don't know. And it's also the largest one it's a centimeter in length. So it's the biggest species in this group as well. So it's the most sort of easy to spot. So we're a little worried about that one. But that's another problem is we see ice fields getting smaller, snow fields getting smaller. And that's one of the long-term predictions for a much warmer world is to have a lot less ice and snow.
And so what are some reasons that people should care about what happens to bugs? Like, what is the ripple effect as climate change affects their populations and their ecosystems?
Great question. You know, insects form this kind of glue that helps hold ecosystems together. They're doing all kinds of what we call ecosystem services, pollinating plants, decomposing dead material, and providing a massive food source to birds and fish and mammals. So if all the insects were to immediately be removed from an ecosystem, you would rather soon see the disappearance of birds, fish, a lot of flowers, a lot of plants would disappear. And then when it comes to human commerce and our agriculture, we have millions of dollars invested in crops that rely on insects. And if they were to disappear, we would have a lot of gaps in our food supply chain. So it would be a much less biodiverse world. The ripple effect of losing insects would lead, we're already in what scientists think is the sixth mass extinction event the Earth has seen. You know, the last really big one took out the dinosaurs, and now we're losing thousands of species every year due to habitat alteration and invasive species, pollution, climate change, all of these factors. And it's just getting to be far less biodiverse. So if insects were to really disappear, humans wouldn't have a lot of things you care about, a lot of the things we care about and subsist on, fish, birds, et cetera, would struggle a lot as well.
I read an article in which you were quoted, and it was about the bumblebee population and how they're an endangered species, but the Alaska population seems to be doing okay. That was a couple of years back. Is that still the case?
Right. So you're talking about the Western bumblebee. So that's one. Yeah, that's one species of about 20 that we have in Alaska. And it is found throughout Alaska, down along the west coast of North America into, I think it gets all the way down to California. And in the lower 48, it's disappearing. Just shockingly low numbers. But up in the northern latitudes, it seems to be doing fine. It's actually still one of our more common species. So that species of bumblebee seems to be doing okay up here. But that really needs a lot more study. We don't know why we see that major difference. So there's people very interested in that question.
So what are some of the things you'll be covering in your talk this Friday, your evening at Egan lecture?
Yeah, so some of the stuff I've already mentioned, the importance of insects globally, the sort of global studies that have looked at insect changes related to climate change, and then bring it more down to specific Alaskan examples, and including questions about invasive species, things like they're not insects, but they are arthropods, the ticks, for example, are beginning to appear in Alaska that are going to be a real nuisance to our pets and could be a real problem to moose if the winter moose tick gets into Alaska. So we're very worried about some of these things, but I should mention that there's a lot of opportunity for citizens to help out with this, keeping track of all this. There are two Facebook groups, one called the Spiders of Alaska and one called the Bugs and Plants of Alaska. And people post pictures in those Facebook groups of spiders and insects that they have seen in Alaska. And some of these postings have led to specimens coming into the museum that are non-native species to Alaska that are being introduced. So it's like the first documentation is coming into the museum because of these Facebook groups for some of these species, which is really great. And There's another online app that I'm very fond of called iNaturalist, which also has this kind of Star Trekking ability to automatically identify insects that you photograph with the app using image recognition, the same kind of technology that Facebook uses to recognize your face, or do you want to tag your grandmother, whatever. So that technology is being used to identify insects now, or organisms in general. iNaturalist is not just for insects. I mean, if you want to know what flower that is or what fungus that is, iNaturalist is a great way to go, because it not only does that for you, but it also, your photograph becomes a scientific observation in a huge database. And so it helps science. So I'm really, really excited about that as well.
Excellent. Well, I'll stop you there so that we don't give away too much more of your Evening at Egan lecture. I understand it will be happening at 7 p.m. on Zoom, and that it's free, but people need to register. Are there any additional details you want to share with our listeners about how to watch your talk?
Yeah, that's about all I know. I guess you do have to pre-register, and it is free. But I always get great questions from people, so I really look forward to getting those.
Good. I'm glad folks will have a chance to submit their questions. I'm sure they'll be really interested in knowing some things that you have to say about our insects up here and climate change. Are you incorporating any multimedia elements that we can look forward to?
You mean like movies or something?
Videos, images, anything like that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It'll be a slideshow for sure. Yeah. So there'll be a lot of good pictures. I take a lot of pictures of insects as well. I should add, since we're on the radio, one of the non-native species we don't yet have in Alaska is the brown recluse. And that is something I always have interest in conversations with people about, because there's always somebody who says, no, I know somebody who was bitten by a brown recluse in Alaska. We have yet to find any specimens, and so I'll talk more about that in my talk as well. Yeah.
Professor of Entomology and Curator of Insects, Derek Sykes, University of Fairbanks, thank you so much for joining me today. We will put a link to how to sign up for your talk on the post for this interview. Thanks so much for joining me today. Anything else you want to share with our listeners before you say goodbye?
Keep looking for insects, even though it's getting colder out there.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yep. Thank you.